Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. This is your election guru, Mark Brown here. Glad you could join us today. And I remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items written in Ayers, LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Okay, now we've got that straightened out. We're doing national stuff this week. But first, we're going to start off with, yeah, you guessed it, an obituary. This is from the Los Angeles Times, Saturday, March 15, 2025. Alan Simpson, 1931 to 2025, a three-term Republican senator and uncommonly generous man. The politician from Wyoming reached across party lines with his wit and kindness. By Mead Groover. Cheyenne, Wyoming. Former Senator Alan Simpson, a political legend whose quick wit bridged partisan gaps in the years before today's political acrimony, has died. He was 93. Simpson died early Friday after struggling to recover from a broken hip in December, according to a statement from his family and the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, a group of museums where he was a board member for 56 years. He was an uncommonly generous man, Pete Simpson, his older brother said in the statement. And I mean generous in an absolutely unconditional way. Giving of his time and giving of his energy, and he did it in politics and he did it in the family forever. Along with former Vice President Dick Cheney, Simpson was a towering Republican figure from Wyoming, the least populated state. Unlike Cheney, Simpson was famous for his humor. We have two political parties in this country, the Stupid Party and the Evil Party. I belong to the Stupid Party was among Simpson's many well-known quips. Simpson had a huge impact on immigration law and policy. Along with Representative Romano L. Mazzoli, a Democrat from Kentucky, he sponsored the Immigration Reform and Control Act, often referred to as the Simpson-Mazzoli Bill, which offered legal residency to thousands of people living in the country without authorization. The bill, signed into law by President Reagan in 1986, also made it a crime for employers to knowingly hire someone who was in the country illegally. Reagan hailed the law as a truly successful bipartisan effort and said, "Future generations of Americans will be thankful for our efforts to humanely regain control of our borders and thereby preserve the value of one of the most sacred possessions of our people, American citizenship." A political moderate by current standards, Simpson's three terms as senator from 1979 to 1997 covered the Republican Party's rejuvenation under President Reagan. Simpson played a key role rallying GOP senators from around the party's legislative agenda as a top Senate leader during that time. Simpson was better known for holding his own views, though, with sometimes caustic certainty. A deficit hawk with sharp descriptions of people who relied on government assistance, Simpson supported abortion rights, an example of moderation that contributed to his fade in the GOP. His Democratic friends included Robert Reich, Labor Secretary under President Clinton, and Norman Mineta, Transportation Secretary under President George W. Bush. Simpson and Mineta met as Boy Scouts when Mineta and his family were imprisoned as Japanese Americans in the Heart Mountain War Relocation Center near Simpson's hometown of Cody, Wyoming, during World War II. After leaving politics, both promoted awareness of the incarceration of some 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry in camps during the war. Mineta, who died in 2022, recalled that Simpson was once asked what was the biggest difference between them as a Republican and a Democrat. Alan thought about it and he said, "Well, I wear a size 15 shoes and he wears a size 8.5," Mineta replied, according to the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. Simpson was gifted in crossing party lines and building bipartisan consensus, Colin Simpson, one of his three children and a former Wyoming House Speaker, said in a statement. Dad and Pete have anchored the extended Simpson family for decades with the same love, humor, compassion, and dedication their parents did before them, he said. Dad was a mighty force, and with Mom's steady hand by his side, we are so blessed and proud to have been along for the ride of a lifetime. In 2010, President Obama tasked Simpson with co-leading a debt reduction commission that developed a plan to save $4 trillion through tax hikes and spending cuts. The plan lacked support for serious consideration by Congress. At 6 feet seven, Simpson was literally a towering figure, tallest on record in the Senate until Alabama GOP Senator Luther Strange, who was 6 feet nine, took office in 2017. Big as Simpson's shoes were, he had huge ones to fill politically. His father, Millward Simpson, was a governor, U.S. senator, and state legislature. His mother, Lorna Cooey Simpson, was president of the Red Cross in Cody and on the local planning commission. "I thought Dad loved politics and the law, and I wanted to do that," Simpson once said. Simpson was born in Denver in 1931. After a childhood of reckless gun shooting and vandalism in Cody that put him in danger and in trouble with the law, he graduated from Cody High School in 1949 and the University of Wyoming in 1954. Also that year, he married Ann Schroll of Grable, Wyoming, and joined the U.S. Army, where he served in the 5th Infantry Division and the 2nd Armored Hell on Wheels Division in Germany. Alan and Ann Simpson celebrated their 70th wedding anniversary with a community ice cream social attended by relatives and hundreds of others in a Cody park last summer. After leaving the Army, Simpson got a law degree from the University of Wyoming in 1958 and joined his father's law practice, where he worked for the next 19 years. He was elected to the Wyoming House in 1964 and served there until his election to the U.S. Senate in 1976. A football and basketball athlete at the University of Wyoming, Simpson fondly described politics as a contact sport. "I've been called everything," he said in 2003. "What the hell? If you don't like the combat, get out." Simpson's candor made him popular with voters. He also was well known as a well-read, hard-working, and sometimes hard-nosed politician involved in immigration, veterans affairs, and environmental issues. He served on the Immigration Subcommittee and the Veterans Affairs Committee, among others. Simpson opposed sentences of life without parole for juveniles and said he supported review of criminal sentences after a period of time. When they get to be 30 or 40 and they've been in the clink for 20 years, or 30 or 40, and they have learned how to read and how to do things, why not? He told the Associated Press in 2009. By 1995, he had had enough of the Senate and decided not to run again. "Part of me said I could do this for another 3 or 4 years, but not 6, he said at that time. "The old fire in the belly is out. The edge is off." Others of his family in politics and government included his older brother, Pete, a University of Wyoming historian who served in the Wyoming House and was the unsuccessful Republican nominee for governor in 1986. Alan Simpson's son, Colin, was Speaker of the Wyoming House, and his nephew, Millward Simpson, directed the State Parks Department. After leaving the Senate, Simpson taught about politics and the media at Harvard University and the University of Wyoming. In speeches, he often urged college students to be politically involved. In 2022, President Biden awarded Simpson the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Simpson is survived by his wife, Anne, his brother, Pete Simpson, sons, Colin Simpson and William Simpson, and daughter Susan Simpson Gallagher. That was Alan Simpson, 1931 to 2025, a 3-term Republican senator and uncommonly generous man, by Meg Groover from the Los Angeles Times for Saturday, March 15, 2025. Groover writes for the Associated Press. Time Stuff writer Steve Padilla contributed to this report. And now onto an article regarding the mayoral race in New York City, and somebody is trying to make a comeback. This is from the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, March 2, 2025. Former Governor Cuomo launches bid for New York mayor, from the Associated Press. New York. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo announced Saturday that he is running for mayor of New York City, relaunching his political career following a years-long exile over a barrage of sexual harassment accusations. In a 17-minute video announcing his bid, Cuomo pitched himself as an accomplished moderate who could save a city that felt threatening and out of control and is capable of navigating the delicate balance between working with Republican President Trump and fighting with him when necessary. "I am not saying this is going to be easy. It won't be easy. but I know we can turn the city around, and I believe I can help. And that is why I announce my candidacy today for mayor of New York City, he said. The Democrat is expected to mount a formidable campaign, despite entering the race deeply wounded by the scandal that forced his resignation from the office, governor's office in 2021. He takes on a large field of primary opponents with low name recognition, plus an incumbent Mayor Eric Adams, who for now remains under indictment on federal corruption charges, and under scrutiny from critics who question his independence from Trump. Cuomo enters the race with fundraising prowess, a record of accomplishments over his 3 years as governor, and potential support among many of these same moderate voters who helped propel Adams to office. Yet it is unclear whether voters were willing to give Cuomo another chance after his remarkable downfall 3.5 years ago, when he went from being hailed for his leadership during the onslaught of COVID-19 to being castigated for his behavior with women and questioned about his response to the pandemic. In his campaign video, Cuomo acknowledged past mistakes but didn't directly mention the harassment allegations. Did I always do everything right in my years of government service? Of course not, he said. Would I do things differently knowing what I know now? Certainly. Did I make mistakes, some painfully? Definitely. And I believe I learned from them and that I am a better person for it, and I hope to show that every day. Cuomo has been circling a return to politics for years while his lawyers and political consultants kept trying to discredit his accusers. At least 12 women credibly accused him of sexual harassment, which included allegations of unwanted kissing and touching, as well as remarking about their looks and sex lives, according to a report released by New York's Attorney General. One aide later filed a criminal complaint accusing Cuomo of grabbing her breast while they were alone in the governor's mansion in Albany in late 2020. Cuomo denied the sexual assault allegation, which a prosecutor ultimately dropped on the grounds that there wasn't enough proof to get a conviction. As for his behavior with some of the other women, Cuomo said he did not intentionally mistreat them and had simply fallen behind the times of what was considered appropriate workplace conduct. Taxpayers have spent millions of dollars defending him against various lawsuits related to the allegations. That was former Governor Cuomo launches bid for New York mayor from the Associated Press out of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, March 2nd, 2025. All right, now we move on to this one from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times for Sunday, March 6, 2025. To win back voters, Democrats point to eggs. Party leaders focus on grocery costs while many activists raise alarm on perceived threat to democracy, by Steve Peoples. New York. As their party struggles to navigate the early days of Donald Trump's second presidency, some Democrats are convinced that their road to recovery lies in the price of eggs. Instead of leaning into Trump's tear down of the federal government or his alliance with billionaire Lieutenant Elon Musk, they're steering to what they perceive as the everyday concerns of Americans, none more important than grocery prices and eggs in particular. U.S. egg prices hit a record average of $4.95 per dozen in January, surpassing a previous record set in January 2023, according to federal data. In some parts of the country, they're much higher. A Safeway supermarket in San Francisco was selling a dozen eggs for $10.99 last week. The U.S. Department of Agriculture expects egg prices to rise 41% this year over last year's average of $3.17 per dozen. Already, some restaurants are adding temporary surcharges when customers order eggs. Denny's said its surcharge varies by region and even by restaurant, while Waffle House added a 50-cent surcharge for egg at all its restaurants. The Democratic establishment's focus on blaming Trump for those price spikes represents a starkly different approach than that of its rank-and-file activists who have launched a movement arguing that Trump is a budding dictator with no regard for the Constitution. Such concerns may be valid, some Democratic members of Congress say, but they don't resonate with working-class Americans trying to feed their families. When that is your day-to-day worry, the philosophical conversations about a constitutional crisis or the democracy is simply not a luxury you can afford, said Representative Kristen McDonnell Rivette, Democrat of Michigan. I'm not saying we should worry about those things, because we should, and they are important, but they are not primary in the minds of people in Saginaw, Michigan. The message underscores the Democratic ecosystem's acknowledgement that the party must make changes to win back voters worried about the economy, who shifted toward Trump last fall and gave Republicans control of the White House and both chambers of Congress. It's unclear, however, whether the Democrats' newfound focus will do much in the short term to stop Trump's sweeping campaign to consolidate power in Washington, or if it can harness the energy of the party's progressive base, which wants new and creative solutions to address what it views as an existential threat. Indivisible co-founder Ezra Levin, whose organization helped coordinate a nationwide protest movement that put House Republicans on defense, called the Democrats' focus on eggs a communication strategy built for a 1990s policy fight. They're looking at polls that say inflation is unpopular, and they think Dems can win people with boring, tired talking points, Levin said. But it's 2025. This isn't how politics works anymore. And their failure to update their approach to creeping authoritarianism is a simple failure of leadership. The Democratic establishment's new approach echoed across Washington after Trump delivered a 99-minute speech Tuesday to a joint session of Congress. Trump defended the tariffs he has imposed on America's trading partners and revoked in some cases. A trade war could boost prices further on goods, including fruits and vegetables, cell phones, lumber, and cars. In the opening hours of Trump's presidency, the Democratic National Committee issued talking points to encourage allies to talk about Trump's plans to screw over America and highlight his alliances with Musk and other tech billionaires. The DNC's talking points sounded different after Tuesday's speech. We saw Trump ramble on about invading Greenland and planting the American flag on Mars. But what we didn't hear was a plan to lower costs and address Americans' anxiety about the looming economic disaster he's driving us toward, read the DNC talking points. Consumer confidence has fallen sharply. Everyday costs are skyrocketing, and congressional Republicans are pushing deeply unpopular tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy. At the same time, Democratic officials shared new internal data Thursday that they say indicates inflation and the cost of living are voters' top priority. Democracy, by contrast, ranked number 12. Public polling goes further. A Washington Post Ipsos poll found that 1 month into the new administration, U.S. adults remain almost universally unhappy about the cost of groceries. According to the survey, about 9 in 10 Americans say that food prices are not so good or poor, including about half who say they are poor. And a CNN SSRS poll conducted in mid-February found that about 6 in 10 Americans said Trump had not gone far enough in trying to reduce the price of everyday goods. But the opposition party is hardly united on the new approach. Representative Al Green, Democrat of Texas, was ejected from the House chamber during Trump's speech and eventually censored for refusing to stop shouting his concerns about potential Medicaid cuts. Other Democrats silently waved small signs that read, "Musk steals, save Medicaid," and "lies." Still others skipped the speech or left early in protest. In Tuesday's speech, Trump blamed the surge on his Democratic predecessor. "Joe Biden especially let the price of eggs get out of control, the egg prices out of control. We're working hard to get it back down," Trump contended as Democrats in the chamber booed. The industry, and most experts agree, that the ongoing bird flu outbreak is the main reason egg prices are setting records, although some question whether egg producers are inflating prices to boost profits, a hint of the perceived price gouging Kamala Harris had highlighted during her losing campaign against Trump. As further evidence that Trump's team is aware that the situation is becoming a political liability, Musk used his social media platform Thursday to cast more blame on Biden. "There was an insane slaughter of 150 million egg-laying chickens ordered by the Biden administration," Musk wrote on X, neglecting to mention the millions of egg-laying chickens killed since Trump took office. As of Thursday afternoon, 27,116,857 birds have been killed to limit the spread of bird flu since Trump returned to the White House. That's because the federal government's long-standing policy requires farmers to kill their entire flocks anytime a bird gets sick to help limit the spread of the virus. Overall, more than 166 million birds, most of them egg-laying chickens, have been slaughtered since the outbreak began in 2022. The Trump administration did unveil a plan to combat bird flu to help ease egg prices, but the effect is hard to predict given that the $1 billion plan isn't a drastic departure from the previous policy. Specifically, Trump's plan doesn't change the USDA's long-standing policy of slaughtering flocks when a sick bird is found. Instead, it focuses on helping farmers adopt the most effective biosecurity measures to keep the virus out and explores the prospects for a bird flu vaccine, among other moves. Representative Josh Riley, Democrat of New York, who recently confronted a bird flu outbreak in his upstate district, said almost every conversation he has with constituents centers on rising prices, especially eggs. He made a direct link between concerns about the economy and democracy. If you're worried about our democracy, that's more of a reason to be worried about the price of eggs, Riley said. The reason our democracy is in the situation is because for decades, politicians have neglected the needs of everyday working people. He continued, "Is it any wonder, after 40 years of shipping jobs overseas just to make Wall Street rich, after 3 years of egg prices skyrocketing, and nobody around this place doing a goddamn thing about it, that people are really, really frustrated and believe that our democracy does not work for them?" That was "To Win Back Voters, Democrats Point to Eggs" by Steve Peoples from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Sunday, March 9, 2025. Peoples writes for the Associated Press. Other AP writers contributed to this report. All right, now we've got a special article from a site called centerforpolitics.org. And this is called "Our Initial Senate Ratings, Republicans Start as Strong Favorites to Hold Majority" by Kyle Condick and J. Miles Coleman, published on February 13, 2025. While Republicans, who will be defending 22 of the 35 Senate seats up in 2026, may have the political environment working against them next year, they are still favored to retain the chamber. Part of the reason for this is that Democrats hold two of our three initial toss-up races, Georgia and Michigan, while GOP-held North Carolina will likely see another hotly contested Senate race. "We are giving Maine's Susan Collins, Republican, a degree of deference by starting her race as Leans Republican, although as the only Republican representing a Kamala Harris one state, it is hard to see Democrats getting close to a majority without her seat. If Democrats were to be on track to regain the Senate by the end of the decade, they would almost certainly have to come out of the 2026 cycle with a net gain of seats. The last two midterm elections help illustrate why, even though the presidential party often draws the ire of the electorate in midterm elections, the trend of seat loss is much clearer in the House than in the Senate. In both 2018 and 2022, the president's party lost the majority in the House of Representatives. While Democrats seem to overperform expectations in the House in 2018, and Republicans seem to underperform in 2022, the basic result of those elections was the same. Voters put a check on the president by taking the House majority away from his party. But in the Senate, the story was different. In each of those years, the president's party netted seats. Republicans came out of 2018 with 53 seats after they had won 52 in 2016, and Democrats came out of 2022 with 51 seats after they had won 50 in 2020. A basic politics 101 explanation for the differences in outcomes in each of those years is simply that all 435 House seats are elected every 2 years, while only a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. So the makeup of the Senate map matters greatly in determining the outcome. In 2018, Democrats were defending the lion's share of the seats contested, including in several states that are deeply Republican at the presidential level. Republicans flipped a number of these seats in that election and then finished the job 6 years later. In 2024, we looked at the partisan realignment of the Senate following the election. Meanwhile, in 2022, Republicans were defending more seats than Democrats, and a combination of factors allowed Democrats to defend all of their vulnerable seats while flipping an open seat in battleground Pennsylvania. We see this dynamic throughout recent midterm history. Table 1 shows how the presidential party has performed on average in midterms since the end of World War II. Midterms 1946 to 2022. For the House, number of elections 20, presidential party lost seats 18, presidential party gained seats 2, no change 0, average presidential party losing negative 25.8. Senate, number of elections 20, presidential party lost seats 13, presidential party gained seats 6, no change 1, average presidential party loss negative 3.6. The source calculated by from the Vital Statistics on Congress. There have been 20 midterms in this post-war era, starting in 1946. In 18 of those elections, the president's party has lost seats in the House, with exceptions coming in the back-to-back midterm cycles of 1998 and 2002. But in the Senate, the presidential party penalty is less pronounced. Yes, the president's party more often than not loses seats in the Senate. But in 7 of the 20 elections, the president's party either played to a draw or actually netted seats, as we saw in the last couple of midterms. The specifics of the 2026 map give the Republicans an opening to once again produce an exception to the midterm seat loss trend for the presidential party in the Senate, although Democrats have credible targets too. Republicans find themselves defending 22 seats this cycle, while Democrats are only defending 13. However, 20 of the 22 Republican-held seats are in states that Donald Trump won by double digits, leaving only Maine, which is reliably Democratic for president, but which has a proven incumbent in Republican Susan Collins, and North Carolina, a GOP-leaning battleground where Republican Tom Tillis is seeking a third term, and obvious Democratic targets. Meanwhile, 11 of the 13 Democratic Senate seats are states that never voted for Donald Trump, while a pair, Georgia, defended by first-term Senator John Ossoff, Democrat, as well as an open seat in Michigan, voted for Trump in 2 of his 3 elections. These 4 states, 2 on each side, form the competitive core of the 2026 Senate map. This basic alignment works out well for Republicans because if this holds, and there really are only 4 highly competitive Senate races, the worst they could do would be to lose 2 net seats, which would still keep them in the majority at 51-49. Republicans are clearly favored to hold the Senate at the starting line of the 2026 cycle. In the conclusion, we'll set some expectations for how we're planning to judge the cycle. But first, let's go a little bit more into depth on our initial ratings, including these 4 races and a handful of other contests we are starting in a category other than safe. Last year, the presidential race hinged on 7 states that were widely considered toss-ups. Of those 7, there 3 will host Senate races in this cycle and are starting out in the toss-up category. In the Southeast, the aforementioned Ossoff and Tillis are the most vulnerable members from their respective parties. Both incumbents could find themselves in marquee races against popular former or outgoing governors. National Republicans would love for Governor Brian Kemp, Republican of Georgia, to challenge Ossoff, while Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee Chairwoman Kristen Gillibrand, Democrat of New York, has name-checked former Governor Roy Cooper, Democrat, as a strong potential candidate in North Carolina. However, even if both Kemp and Cooper decline, there have been instances in recent years of governors passing on potential promising contests, most notably now former Governor Chris Sununu, Republican of New Hampshire in 2022, Georgia and North Carolina are so critical both sides' math that we'd be shocked if those states did not see costly contests. While Georgia's red lane has lessened over the past decade, the state GOP still retains an ample farm team. With that, national Republicans feel they can beat Ossoff even if Kemp doesn't make the race. Representative Buddy Carter, Republican, Georgia 1st District, and State Insurance Commissioner John King, Republican, have expressed some interest in the race, although both seem to be deferring to Kemp. We note that Carter is in office because his predecessor, Jack Kingston, ran for this Senate seat in 2014, While Kingston put up crushing margins with the voters who knew him best in the Savannah area, he lost a primary runoff because Metro Atlanta voted against him. And what could be interpreted as an attempt to raise his profile with primary voters, Carter made news this week by taking up a Trump cause and introducing legislation that would authorize the United States to acquire and rename Greenland. Far-right Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia 14, has not ruled out challenging Ossoff. If she ran, we could easily see Democrats or their allies boosting her in a contested primary, as they have done in many other contests in recent years. In the 2022 midterm cycle, Georgia was one of a handful of swing states that illustrated the importance of candidate quality. As Kemp led much of the statewide GOP ticket to victory, the only Republican statewide candidate who lost was former football star Herschel Walker, whose personal baggage was too much for him to overcome against Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat. Kemp is strong enough that he could hypothetically push this race out of the toss-up category and towards the Republicans' column in advance of Election Day. Green, on the other hand, could push it the opposite way. Moving to North Carolina, Tillis has long been a Republican whom the conservative grassroots has viewed with at least a modicum of suspicion. However, over the past several weeks, Tillis has moved to shore up his right flank by taking a visible role in backing Trump's cabinet nominees. In a Cooperless Democratic primary, former Representative Wiley Nickel, Democrat of North Carolina's 13th, would seem to have a head start. In 2022, Nickel won a very marginal Raleigh area seat before state Republicans drastically reconfigured the map for 2024. In late 2023, he announced that he had set its sights on a 2026 Senate bid instead of re-election to the House, although we presumed he'd ultimately stand down if Cooper entered the race. It may be tempting to chalk up Tillis' past election successes to macro factors that were at play during his campaigns. In 2014, he flipped a Romney won state in a pro-GOP wave year, and in 2020, he was re-elected as Trump carried his state. But as one of our Republican contacts half joked last year, the guy has never led in a poll, but he's the state's senior senator, something that to us speaks to Tillis' skills as a political operator. Of the 25 states that voted for Trump three times, a group that holds half the nation's Senate seats, North Carolina is the most competitive state. Republicans have blocked Democrats from winning a Senate race there since the late Senator Kay Hagan's Democratic victory in 2008. But Republicans also did not have to defend a Senate seat in North Carolina in the last two pro-Democratic midterms, 2006 and 2018. If Democrats are to win back the Senate majority anytime soon, they will probably need at least one of North Carolina's seats. A few weeks ago, we touched on Michigan's Senate contest shortly after Senator Gary Peters, Democrat, announced his retirement. While we hinted at it back then, we are formalizing our toss-up rating today. Although there haven't been any major candidacy announcements from either side, the contours of the race may be taking shape. Former Representative Mike Rogers, Republican of Michigan's 8th, is reportedly close to announcing a second bid for the Senate in as many cycles. Last year, he lost to now-Senator Elissa Slotkin, Democrat, by 0.3 points, which represented Republicans' best showing in a Michigan Senate race since 1994, the last year where they actually won. Rogers' entrance into this race would be a good development for Republicans, although he may not get a clear primary field. Meanwhile, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Democrat, is reportedly taking a serious look at the contest. Though he previously served as mayor of South Bend, Indiana, he has been a resident of his husband's hometown, Traverse City, Michigan, for the past few years. In recent cycles, Democrats have had success at making the carpetbagger label stick to some Republican candidates in key contests. With Buttigieg, Democrats would probably risk giving Republicans a similar opening. In fact, an Epic MRA poll from earlier this week gave Rogers a 47-41% lead over Buttigieg. While early polling is not always predictive, we're watching to see if any potential Stop Buttigieg movements appears among Michigan Democrats. State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who represents a Detroit area seat and is known as a strong fundraiser, is reportedly preparing to run. And term-limited State Attorney General Dana Nessel is another possibility. Do we think Buttigieg, despite his appeal to college-educated Democrats and never-Trumpers, has a lot to prove as a Senate candidate, particularly in a state where black turnout is so crucial to Democrats? It is reasonable to wonder how Buttigieg, who never gained traction with black voters during his 2020 presidential primary run, would motivate that crucial bloc. In a midterm, with a Republican in the White House, Democrats should win a Senate race in Michigan, but there's enough uncertainty that we thought a toss-up rating was merited to start this contest. The only state that we put in the leans category from either side is Maine. While we are doing this, at least for now, as a nod to the crossover support that Susan Collins has generated through the years, given the bigger state of play, we fully expect it'll eventually make its way towards the toss-up column. Collins, at 72, was running for a sixth term. For now, Democrats are searching for a candidate. Governor Janet Mills, Democrat, remains popular and will be termed out in 2026. While she did not close the door on challenging Collins, Mills, who will turn 79 shortly before the next Congress is sworn in. Looking to Maine's House delegation, Representative Chelly Pingree, Democrat of Maine's 1st, could run, although she lost to Collins by 17 points in 2002 Senate contest, while Representative Jared Golden, Democrat of Maine's 2nd, who has won perpetually close contests in a Trumpy seat, seems more likely to run to replace Mills if he runs statewide. A September 2024 poll from the Portland-based Pan-Atlantic Research gave Collins a 49-47% favorable rating spread. So to us, Collins would start a re-election effort from a positive but not insurmountable position. It may be worth noting that the same poll found Harris leading by 9 points in the presidential race, and she went on to win the state by a comparable 7-point margin. Either side has 2 races apiece in our likely category, although going by presidential numbers alone, our Democratic states are shakier for the incumbent party than their Republican counterparts. Minnesota and New Hampshire are mildly blue states where Harris' single-digit margins last year were worse than Biden's from 2020, but better than those that Hillary Clinton got in 2016. Senator Tina Smith, Democrat of Minnesota, is not the electoral juggernaut that her same state colleague Amy Klobuchar, Democrat, has proven to be. But even as some recent statewide Republicans have come close in Minnesota, the better than 2-to-1 margins that the core Twin Cities metro counties give to Democrats have been tough for the GOP to overturn. In the Granite State, Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat, has not announced whether she'll seek a 4th term, although her recent fundraising does not suggest that she is. If Shaheen retires, Representative Chris Pappas, Democrat of New Hampshire's 1st, who has held down more the more competitive of the state's 2 districts with relative ease since 2018, would be a name to watch, as would Stephanie Shaheen, the incumbent's daughter, who previously served as a local official in Portsmouth. Former Senator Scott Brown, Republican of Massachusetts, who held Shaheen to a 3-point win in 2014, posted a selfie with National Republican Senatorial Committee Chairman Tim Scott, with the implication seeming to be that another Senate run could be forthcoming. After that 2014 loss, Brown became a relatively early backer of Trump's 2016 campaign and served as ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa during Trump's 1st term. Brown would bring some name recognition to the campaign, but it seems unlikely that the 2026's political environment would be as advantageous to Republicans as 2014's was. While New Hampshire Republicans have done well in state-level races in recent years, they hold a trifecta. Their performance in federal races has been far weaker, which is also why we give Democrats more of the benefit of the doubt. While Republicans could very possibly come out of 2026 with a net gain in the Senate, if more typical midterm patterns take hold, that is to say, if public opinion turns markedly against the presidential party, a dynamic that worked against Republicans in 2006 and then Democrats in 2010 and 2014, some double-digit Trump states will inevitably seem more competitive. While we are leaving most of those states in the safe Republican category for now, we are flagging Ohio and Texas as potential wave watch prospects by calling them likely Republican. In the case of the Ohio special election, Democrats are apparently lobbying former Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat, to run against Senator John Husted, Republican, who was recently appointed to replace now Vice President J.D. Vance. Last year, Brown lost his seat by just over 3 percentage points to now Senator Bernie Moreno, Republican, although he was one of the Senate Democrats' strongest overperformers. Well, folks, that'll bring us to the end of another edition of Voter Information. So for everything that is happening with elections and elected officials right here in the city, the state, and the nation, find it all right here. Until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Braun, saying to you, happy voting and peace.